The next matter for oral argument, which is United States v. Michael Hester. Ms. Oliveira.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, my name is Leticia Oliveira and I represent Michael Hester. With the Court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. Our appeal addresses two errors. First, the District Court's denial of Mr. Hester's motion to suppress and the Court's application of a four-level enhancement for possession of a firearm in connection with another felony offense.
Let me start with the firearms enhancement. What's the prejudice here? Where's the prejudice? The judge increased by four and then decreased by four and sentenced your client to relatively the bottom end of the guidelines. So where's the prejudice?
The prejudice here is in that the incorrect application of the guideline enhancement affected his sentence.
How? Because he then reduced it by the same number he increased it and went to the bottom end of the guideline.
He said that's what he was doing. He explained why he was giving the decrease. He gave the application of a positive, which he said was crazy, and then he went on to mitigate that.
The judge very clearly expressed on the record his reasons for granting a variance in this case.
And given the record that both of my colleagues have just referred to, isn't it a fair conclusion by us that what the district court had here in mind was a specific sentence? He accounted for the craziness of this enhancement, reduced the sentence concomitant to that enhancement, and got to the sentence that he thought was appropriate. Don't you think that's what happened here? And it doesn't the record supports that as what happened here.
I think the record shows that Judge McNulty saw a need for a four-level variance in this case based on the harshness of the enhancement.
A variance from what?
A variance from an offense level that included this enhancement.
Right.
So the law on this is clear. An error in the calculation of the guideline range will only in rare cases be shown to be harmless. This is not one of those rare cases.
Why
because,
not?
Because on this record, we cannot be sure of what Judge McNulty would have done without the application of the enhancement.
Didn't he say that? Didn't he say, he specifically said why he was varying downward from the sentence that would otherwise...
He said he's varying downward, but what he didn't say is that he's not taking this enhancement into account, which is what you need in order for this to be harmless. We don't know on this record what Judge McNulty would have done if he hadn't had to grant a four-level variance in this case.
And you said we can't be sure. What is the test that we are required to apply in making some determination as to... whether this was harmless error here?
I think we have to be certain that the error didn't affect the ultimate sentence. And in this case, as I mentioned, the judge grants a four-level variance. The starting point in this case is not after he grants the four-level variance. It's an offense level that includes that four-level enhancement.
Well, the judge clearly understood his authority to vary. He could have varied further if had he so deemed appropriate, right?
Yes.
And he didn't.
He didn't. But the issue here is that after he grants the four-level variance, he looks at a range and he starts from the top of that range and he subtracts the amount of credit that he wants to give Mr. Hester for his time in state custody. On this record, we don't know, would he have started at the top of the range? Would he have started somewhere else in the range? Would he have granted a different type of variance on different grounds if the starting point hadn't been 120 months? And that's just not clear from the record. And I think that it would be a mistake to take all of Judge McNulty's reasons for granting a variance and then consider them as his reasons for not taking this enhancement into account.
So we're assuming the enhancement was inappropriately given. Was he wrong to include the 4 points?
He was wrong to include the 4 points for a couple of reasons. The government in this case justified its decision to seek this enhancement on this court's line of cases, starting with Fenton. Of course, this court recognized in Keller that it's an open question as to whether or not those cases remain viable outside of the context of burglary or drug trafficking. What we have here is a case where the alleged other felony is evidence tampering. This case does not satisfy the Navarro test because the other felony in this case is based on possession of a firearm. As the district court correctly concluded, you know, this isn't what we usually think of when we think of a firearm in a firearm being possessed in connection with another felony, because here the firearm is the other felony. And there's nothing beyond Mr. Hester's possession of the firearm that really plays a role in the other felony offense or even facilitates it. So whether or not this court decides that the Fenton-Navarro line of cases still has any application outside of the context of burglary or drug trafficking, I think the facilitation enhancement in this case is not satisfied, because when we think of facilitation in these cases, we think of the firearm being used as an instrument of violence. The purpose of this enhancement is to address situations where the presence of the firearm creates an increased risk of violence associated with another felony. That's simply not what we have here. And I think that the unfairness that the district court recognized in applying the enhancement in this case is based on the fact that the government is unfairly taking advantage of the fact that the tampered evidence in this case is the firearm, because let's say that the tampered evidence had been a knife or something else. If Mr. Hester would have been found in possession of the firearm and the other object of tampered evidence, there's no way of showing that the possession of the firearm in any way facilitated that other felony offense.
We don't want to take up all your time on the enhancement. What's your position with respect to that suppression motion? Did the judge not, where did the judge go wrong, so to speak?
There are a few places indicated in our brief where we think the judge went wrong. But
there are a few places, in fact, where you're suggesting that there were clearly erroneous determinations made.
That's correct. The district court in this case clearly erred when they found that the officers did not turn on their overhead lights.
What does the record show with respect to that?
So in this case, neither officer testified that they didn't turn on their overhead lights.
So by not testifying that they didn't, did you just use a double negative? I'm trying to understand.
Sorry, just to be more clear, neither officer testified what the court ultimately found. We did not turn on our overhead lights. Neither officer said that. What we have in the record, though, is a police report that one officer testified was true and correct, and that police report says that the officers that pulled up behind turned on their overhead lights.
Was there also testimony, though, that it's the usual practice to have done that?
Yes. So the officer that
Is that the incident report you're talking about?
That's the incident report.
Does that appear anywhere in the record? Because I didn't.
It was entered into evidence at the suppression hearing.
Well, I'm talking about the record before us.
It's not.
All right.
The officer that pulled up behind Mr. Hester, when asked whether or not he turned on the overhead lights, he said, I don't remember, but during any traffic stop.
Constantino, I believe.
Constantino,
he said
yes.
It's their usual practice.
Yes,
that's
he said.
The closest we came to having any acknowledgement that the lights were on is when he says it's their usual practice, correct?
Right. I think he said, uses the word customarily.
Sorry.
That's correct.
Let me ask this, and this might interrupt your train of thought. Hopefully if it does, you can get back to it. But one, even for myself and not for any of my colleagues, because we haven't discussed this case, the problem I have is that there's no finding as to when the actual seizure occurred, unless I missed it. You can argue the seizure occurred when Hester is in a car that is blocked in, and the ground argument is not really blocked in, because it's a mature car in front. But if we don't leave all sense of reality here, I think it's fair to say that if you're sitting as a passenger in a car and a police car pulls up on the side of you and in the back of you, you're not going to really feel like, I think I'm going to go to Dunkin' Donuts and check out the latte today. You're not going to feel free to leave.
That's exactly our position. At the court in this case...
Let's assume you don't feel free to leave. There's also then got to be some submission to the show of authority. That's the show of authority. There's got to be some submission to the show of authority. Take it to the point where your client attempts to get out of the car, and then my concern is there's no really fact findings to the chronology as to when the thought that one officer saw knew was a gun. You would agree that under MIMS, once there is a, maybe you wouldn't agree, once the officers take control of that car, could the officers argue or order all the occupants out of the, in the car out of the car? Because if they could, then how do you avoid getting to a plain view situation? I'm not, do you understand what I mean by that?
I understand what you mean, and I think that that presumes that there's reasonable suspicion here, which of course our position is that the parking violation is not like a traffic violation where the officers probably would have the authority to order everybody out of the car. So I think
you're saying the parking violation is different than the traffic, a moving traffic violation.
That's correct.
Which would almost automatically give rise to Terry because the officer has a right to stop and they have, that MIMS kicks in and you've got plain view.
That's
the
correct.
Christian court considered this the equivalent of a pedestrian stop.
It did. I think the court quite clearly in its legal conclusions says officers in this case approached Mr. Hester like they would approach any pedestrian on the street.
Where's the submission? Either the submission to force or the refusal to submit to the force and the police follow up.
Mr. Hester submitted in this case by staying put. He submitted in the exact same...
That's low, but that's my point. It's not clear to me that he submitted by staying put, so you've got a low situation, and that constitutes the seizure. Or did he stay put for a few seconds, decide to get out of the car, and the court thought that he was feigning submission so that he could execute his escape. Somewhere in there, the thought occurred, and I don't know if that's when he's out of the car or if he's about to get out of the car, but he's actually conveying to the police, I'm about to get out of the car, because if he's getting out of the car in consequence of the car being stopped, then that may be Johnson. I mean, this is the kind of case where we really need exquisite findings of fact that we don't really have in the district court as to the exact sequence of events so we can determine when the seizure occurred.
Well, to take that sequence of events based on the facts that the court did find, I think the show of authority that occurred here was immediate.
That's the stop. Well,
that's the stop.
That's the police rolling up.
Right. Mr. Hester submitted to that show of authority by staying put. He's stationary when the cars pull up, and he stays stationary.
Well, he has to be, unless he's going to be getting out before they pull up, which I guess he could be. But under this scenario, the fact that he's stationary when they pull up doesn't help us much. We don't know when he may have seen the cars.
Well, I think it's fair to assume that he sees the cops as soon as they pull up behind him and next to the car. And he stays stationary as the officers park.
For how long does he stay there before he decides to get out of the car?
So we know based on the officer's testimony that he stays stationary as they park, they get out of the car, they position themselves outside of the exits. They ask the driver for her license. She explains she doesn't have one.
Okay, there are four different officers. So be specific. One officer on the side of the driver's side. Three officers on your client's side.
There's three officers on Mr. Hester's side.
And at the time, he's still sitting in his seat.
And he's still sitting in his seat.
And has anyone said anything to him at the time they come to the side of the car?
They have not said anything to him.
And the driver's not there yet.
The driver is already sitting in the car.
Correct. Okay.
Yes. The officers don't make any statements to Mr. Hester, but the fact that they don't make any commands, I mean, that's something that the district court uses to find that he was never seized, but I think the officers in this case didn't make any commands to Mr. Hester because they didn't have to.
How are we not bound by Hadary in this case?
Because whether somebody submits to a show of authority depends on what they're doing at the time of the show of authority. Hodari is a case that involves flight. This is a case that involves a stationary suspect.
We do have flight. I mean, he does leave, correct?
He does leave, but we have flight after the show of authority and the moment of seizure. This is not a...
Let me get back to the moment of seizure. That's my problem. Put the rabbit in the hat. If he remains stationary when the three officers come to the side of the car, and then he decides to get out, we've got a finding of fact that that was, that the remaining stationary was feigning to set up an opportunity to leave, then how does that get the remaining stationary under low? Why isn't that inconsistent with low and it's more acquidary?
Well, I think this is something that the court addresses in Lowe. In Lowe, I think the government presents an argument that Mr. Lowe looked like he was getting ready to leave. And I think the court quite clearly says that, you know, we can't consider whether we think someone might have been getting ready
to
leave.
There's a finding there by the district court that three steps backward that Lowe took did not constitute flight or an attempt to flee, which made it a lot easier than this situation where we kind of have to read the tea leaves.
Right. Well, I think what we have to do in this case, you have to separate the moment of seizure from the flight. By the time the flight happens, and I think this is what makes this case...
Well, that assumes that the flight did not have anything to do with the seizure. And I'm sure your colleagues would argue that the seizure may well have occurred after the flight, when we wouldn't argue that. After the flight, if there had been no seizure yet, with none of the guns in plain view.
Right, that's correct. And I think the moment of seizure is, of course, critical in this case, like in every case. But I think what makes this case different from Hodari is, and I think the reason why Mr. Hester was illegally seized, is because when the officers approach the car, they make the show of authority, he submits by staying put, and only after that does he flee. And the Fourth Amendment inquiry looks at these encounters in stages. The fact that he flees after the moment of seizure doesn't undercut his seizure. This court's never found that there's some kind of durational requirement or temporal requirement when it comes to a seizure. There's a moment of seizure, and at that moment...
Let me say the seizure. I thought when I was reading the facts in this case, what if someone initially decides to submit because they're really intimidated, then they think, heck this, I'm out of here, man. I have to sit still for this. I'm always controlling this neighborhood. I'm not going to stand for this. I'm out of here. So the person initially submits, and then they change their mind, and they flee, and the police obtain control of them after the flight. All the cases seem to suggest that the seizure occurs when the person, when the police obtain control of them, which would defer this for a minute. How does that play into this, and why don't we have that here? So the momentary submission, he changes his mind, he flees. Doesn't the flight then cancel the submission and take away the moment, or change the moment of seizure?
I don't think so. And in the same way that Mr. Lowe's, you know, failure to raise his hands or comply with a police command, that didn't undermine the fact that he had submitted. I think the rules on this are fairly clear. Once you are seized, if an officer does not have a reasonable justification for that seizure, you know, we don't look at whatever happens after. We look at what is going on as of the moment of seizure and decide right then and there, you know, was the seizure justified and, you know, should the exclusionary rule apply? This court has never looked at, you know, what's going on in someone's head when submitted.
What should the police have done here? You've got a situation where the police were concerned for their own safety. They approach a car, traffic stops, and this is putting this under the general rubric, a traffic stop, even though it's a parked car. Incredibly dangerous situations. The officers don't know who's in that car, what they're dealing with. What should they have done?
Well, Your Honor,
with regard to your client,
I disagree that this is an incredibly dangerous situation. It's a high crime area, but it's also a largely residential area.
Well, it may not be a dangerous situation. My point is, they don't know. They may not find out until it's too late.
They don't know, and they also have no reason to assume that it's a dangerous situation. I mean, the only thing that they've observed here...
But don't they have to take minimum precautions? Should they leave the guns in the car and say, we want to escalate the situation? Let's leave our guns here and just, you know, walk up and talk to these folks and see what they're doing sitting outside the store?
Right. I think what the officers should have done here is maybe pull up alongside the car, lower the window, and say, excuse me, ma'am, I realize that the curb is not marked and there's no parking sign, but you need to move it along because you're illegally parked. If they wanted to give her a parking ticket...
And in some cases, that would have happened.
Of course. If they wanted to give her the parking violation...
She wasn't even in the car when they rolled up. She was coming out of the store, which they believed to be a drug place.
Right. She's in the car by the time that they pull up. She's seated in the car.
My recollection was the same as Judge Chuckles. I thought she wasn't in the car at the time.
Okay.
She comes up. She says she doesn't have a license to drive, and they have given her back the keys and let her drive away.
Right.
And her clients. It's amazing.
Right. It's, you know, what should have happened here is, as I mentioned, they could have asked her to move it along. The curb's not marked. She's not presenting a danger to anybody. If they wanted to give her the ticket, maybe one officer could have gotten off the car, knocked on the window, said, "Good evening, ma'am. You're illegally parked. I'm going to give you a parking ticket."
Did they have enough for a Terry stop at that point?
So I think the question that's before this case is not whether there's enough for a Terry stop.
That's the question Judge Restrepo just asked you, though.
And I'd rather answer a question than your question, too. It's a good question, and I'd like to humor him. So
no.
I'd answer his question and not answer your question. That would be helpful to me.
Neither the Supreme Court nor the circuit have ever held that a traffic stop justifies a Terry stop. So,
back up a second. If you have a traffic stop in the traditional sense, you don't need a Terry stop. You've got grounds to stop the car. And that sets in the whole chain of events. As I said earlier, the MIPS kicks in and Plainview comes into play. So you've got the Terry stop is when you don't otherwise have reason to stop and there's articulable suspicion that would justify the police encountering and having some kind of interaction and investigation.
Right. So in this case, I'm sorry, I went right to the traffic stop because based on these facts, there's no suspicion of criminal activity. What we have is a woman in a residential neighborhood that appears to go into a store that's open, that both officers testify, sell legitimate items, and she comes out. The most natural understanding of her conduct is that she's just bought something. If the officers had some suspicion based on the fact that they know this store to be the site of previous narcotics arrests, that suspicion is not reasonable because it cannot be the case that every single person that visits this store has, you know, gives rise to criminal.
What about the line of cases then that say that in this context, Fourth Amendment context, the intent of the officers doesn't matter? If the police have grounds to do, again, traffic stop where the car is moving, but the real reason they stop is not because they sell it, but because they see four black guys sitting in there and they're suspicious and they want to have a look. The Supreme Court has said that doesn't matter, it's still a legitimate stop.
That is something that is the officer's subjective intent with respect to the reasonableness of the stop text. That, of course, is not something we take
right
into account.
And there is no factual dispute here, has not been any factual dispute, as I understand the condition of the record, that there were facts relative to the placement of this vehicle, the street, the curb, and the parking zone, that the car was parked at a spot and at a distance that made it in violation of parking regulations. Isn't that correct? I mean,
That's correct.
No dispute about that.
There's no dispute about that. Getting back to the question of intent, we think that whether an officer intends to see someone is different about it's different than the subjective justifications for the seizure.
All right. Well, we will have you back then. How much time did you reserve for your
end? I reserved 3 minutes.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Oliveira. And Mr. Romano.
May it please the Court, John Romano for the United States. Let me start first just with that quick factual issue. Page A253 talks about the overhead light situation, and the testimony is from the second officer who's in the unmarked car. He says, "We did not have overhead lights. We might have put on our rear lights, but I don't remember if we did or not."
There's also testimony on that page that it's customary to use their overheads, right?
Customary to use our rear lights. He doesn't have overhead lights. So I just want to point that out, that when Judge McNulty said no overhead lights, there is no testimony that overhead lights were ever used. So I think that's a fair finding.
When the three police officers approach Mr. Hester, is he under seize? Is he seized when they approach him on the side of the car?
I think we agree with Judge McNulty that at that point he was not seized. I think you could look at this, and as we lay in our brief, for the defendant to win here, he needs to run the table on all three of these issues. And we'll start with the first one. Was there a show of authority? The officers park next to and behind the car. They get out. There's no gun.
That's not a show of authority?
By itself, Your Honor, I don't think it is. Let's look at the Mendenhall factors. You know, overwhelming police presence, guns drawn, you know, lights, commands.
So the guns, I mean, just put yourself in the shoes of an ordinary citizen. And I know you're a little different because you've got the assistant U.S. attorney badge that's going to be conveniently on display when you're pulled over. But let's assume you didn't have that badge and you're parked somewhere.
You were an assistant United States attorney.
I didn't have a badge. To this day, I resent that. It's something I go. Martian wouldn't buy us badges.
I don't have a badge either, Ryan. I think you need to look at the factors. Let's look at Drayton. They go on a bus, three officers. There's a small alleyway where you could walk, you know, where you walk on the bus.
Well,
they're
true.
Walking person to person. Yeah. They say that's not a show of authority. So I think if we look at the factors here,
sitting down.
Officers get out. One officer walks up to the driver, who's in the car, by the way, already. So what they see her run out of the store and get into the car. They pull up. Do you have a license? No. Immediately, Mr. Hester says, I can drive, opens the door, drops the gun, runs. So I would say, I think Judge McNulty was correct.
That in that sequence, he was getting out of the car to switch around so that he could drive? Is that what you're saying?
Well, he said something like, I can drive. He opens
they
the door.
Get out of the car, okay.
He drops the gun, they hear it, they yell gun, he runs. So the show of authority, look, I don't even think this court needs to get to any of these issues because it could jump right to the last one. They had probable cause, reasonable suspicion to stop the car, stop its passengers.
Well, there's a difference between reasonable suspicion and probable cause. Are you saying they had probable cause, or are you saying they had reasonable suspicion to justify a Terry Dutch?
Or are you saying alternatively, depending upon how the stop is characterized?
However you want to characterize it, they see a parking violation, yeah, which is undisputed.
What does that give them the authority to do?
They have the authority to walk up to that car, stop everyone who's inside, give a ticket. So everyone who's, this is a traffic stop situation.
The ticket's interesting because there is no ticket here.
There is a ticket. They give two tickets. They give
two. She can't drive.
They give two tickets to the driver for.
But apparently the tickets, they couldn't produce the tickets at the hearing.
They're not in the record, are they?
But there's testimony that they gave tickets, which in fact, I mean.
The tickets themselves are not in the record. What is in the record is testimony that they gave.
Yes, and I think Judge McNulty credited that testimony. A ticket that she had no license and a ticket that she was too close to the crosswalk. At that point, this is just like a traffic stop, and Judge McKee, I think you're right. They exercise caution. They have to make sure that the passengers aren't doing crazy things in the car. They have to, you know, make sure that their safety is ensured. They simply walk up. At that point, they could seize everyone in the car, and that's basically the end. You don't need to go any further than that. Once he's lawfully seized, he drops the gun and he runs. That's in plain view. That's the end of the story.
What is the seizure there? Define what is that seizure?
The moment of the seizure.
The moment they walk up and they tell, you know, they stop the car, at that point they could seize everyone in the car.
He is seized then.
Your Honor, if you look at it that way,
so I'm asking you.
Our point is there's three paths for the government.
No, I'm asking you. When is he?
If you look at this as a traffic stop, the officers have the right to seize everybody at the moment they walk up to the car. If you look at this as a consensual encounter, which I also think you can do, then he's never seized, I don't think. He's
dealing with it. Where is he now? Where is he now? You're not 10 years in prison.
I thought at some point he was essentially tackled, but
he seized at the point where he
sounds kind of like a seizure, unless it's a tackle by the Cleveland Browns. Case.
Of course, after he drops the gun and runs off his tackle, he sees. But the point is, there's a couple of ways to look at this. Judge McNulty looked at it in the alternative, looked at it both different ways. One way is, it's a consensual encounter. They merely walk up to the driver, ask to see her identification. That's not a seizure. That's Florida v. Bostic. You could ask for identification. They ask for identification. He drops the gun and runs. The next way you could look at it is, there was a show of authority. But he didn't submit. As soon as they walk up, she says, I don't have a license. He says, we're good, I could drive. Opens the door and runs. That's very similar to Valentine. You know, he stops, he gives his name, and then he runs. He didn't submit in that situation. The third way you could look at this, the alternative way that Judge McNulty looked at it, is when you're issuing a parking ticket, you seize everyone in the car, and that's lawful. That's based on reasonable suspicion, probable cause. He can't just get up and run. And this circuit has not addressed that yet, but I think it was five or six circuits all have said, parking tickets is like a traffic stop. You can't. I think Judge Easterbrook said, unfortunately, that panel opinion that was withdrawn, which I did not realize. I think he makes a good point. You can't zoom away while someone's giving you a parking ticket. So yes, you are seized at that point. So however you want to look at this, Judge McNulty was correct.
Easterbrook said that he can't zoom away. That doesn't answer the question as to when, because arguably you can, and you're seized when the police catch up with you.
Your Honor, as soon as you walk up and start investigating a ticket situation where you see that there is a parking violation, the officers can seize everyone in that car. It can't be that, unlike at a traffic stop where we pull you over, that you can just drive away.
We're not talking about the driver, we're talking about the passenger.
Well, the passenger is just like, the way we're looking at this in this scenario is like a traffic stop. The officers can order, as someone pointed out, can order the passenger out of the car, can order the passenger to stay in the car, can order the passenger to put their hands up, all of those things. Those people are seized for officer safety. You can't have the passengers just doing things in the car while the officers are standing there issuing a ticket. And dangerous, yes. In fact, here there was a gun in the car. So, yes, it is a very dangerous situation. And quite frankly, I think the officers acted very appropriately here. There's no, again, no evidence of guns.
Don't go that far, because that other person who just said, I don't have a license to drive, they give you the keys, let it drive away. So don't push the argument too far.
Your Honor, they had just found a gun, a loaded gun in the car. I think there were more pressing issues.
Let's move to the sentencing issue here, because there has been a good point made by Ms. Oliveira that this panel ought to see the outcome here as one that we cannot necessarily see as the outcome were we to determine that application for level enhancement was error and the court would have been in a different situation when it imposed sentence than it was when it actually imposed sentence. How can we have that requisite certainty or near certainty that what occurred here occurred irrespective of whatever error, of the error that took place?
Well, the standard is, it's not a near certainty, it's a high probability. Right. And here, I think when you look at it, what Judge McNulty actually said, this is not a situation where he granted an enhancement and then gave some kind of unspecified variance or just gave a low sentence and didn't explain how the connection was made. But he said, I'm going to give the enhancement, but it's a hollow victory. He then said, I'm going to vary to the range that would be if the four-level enhancement did not apply. So he physically went from the range to the range that otherwise would have applied and explained why he was doing it.
But doesn't he also tether that to the credit he was giving this individual for the time he spent in state custody?
Well, that's the second part of the variance, Your Honor. The first part of the variance is very clear. I'm going from whatever it is, 120 to 84 to 105, and the reason is this four-level enhancement. Yes, it technically applies, but I think it's a little crazy. And I don't think he could have been, I mean, he could have been maybe a little bit clearer, but I think he was pretty clear that, you know, the hollow victory, the four, you know, it's a four-point variance because of that enhancement. I mean, these are the words he used. And I think it's highly probable that he, you know, this did not affect the sentence, given what Judge McNulty said. On the enhancement itself, we think it's
yeah, let's talk about the enhancement itself. I'm not going to ask if you think it was a stretch because I know what your answer is going to be. But
I'm not so sure. I think this thing, Mr. Randall, has a great deal of credibility. His boss is sitting back there, one of the more credible lawyers in the world I've ever met. I'm not so sure what it would be if you posed a question to him as a common sense individual as opposed to an advocate who's paid to make a certain argument.
How's that for a skewed question?
I think we could all agree that it's not in the sort of heartland of how this usually applies.
Very well done.
That being said,
masterful.
This has happened in the Navarro case itself. They said this is not a typical use of the enhancement. And again, I would credit what Judge
McNulty did. It's crazy.
I would credit what Judge McNulty did here. The guidelines apply.
I think that we ought to treat Judge McNulty's characterization as a finding of fact and declare error here.
I think what McNulty did here was he said when the guidelines technically apply, the enhancement technically applies, and we think that's right, and I can explain why in a second. I think it technically applies, but I think it's a little harsh, and so I'm varying. So I think that was a commendable thing to do. I think he might have done the right thing. The way that the guideline applies is, or the enhancement applies, possession in connection with another felony offense. Now, this court has a line of cases that's not, I think, crystal clear, but the commission has changed the guideline a little bit, changed the application a little bit. And so what is the test? Is it another felony offense? And the court says that means an offense other than the drug possession.
And what is the offense?
The offense here is evidence tampering. And I think the point that we need to make is, first of all, the elements are different, right? We all agree that the Blockberger test is different elements. Second is, it's a different offense.
But let's focus on the word tampering. What is the actus reus of tampering here?
Well, the statute says alters, destroys, conceals, or removes. And I also point out that there is an intent element there. So let me give you two scenarios, both of which where he possesses the gun but doesn't tamper with it. First scenario, his cousin comes up to him and says, I got this great gun. It's my favorite. Do you want it? He takes it. He now possesses the gun. He's now committed the felon in possession offense, but he hasn't tampered with that gun because he does not have the intent to alter, conceal, or remove.
Right. So how does he tamper with the gun?
In that one, he hasn't tampered with it in that scenario. Here, he's tampered with it because he knows that there's an investigation. He knows that they want to get rid of this gun. This is what he says in the jail calls. He knows all about this. He's going to take the gun, and he's going to hide it. And not just that, the night he is arrested, he is on the street attempting to sell it. That is what he tells his mother and his father and his girlfriend, whoever it is in the jail calls. So this is far more than merely possessing it. And the other example I was going to give you is his cousin comes up to him and says, I use this gun to assault my girlfriend. Do you want to see it? And he takes it and he holds it. He has now committed felon in possession again, but he still has tampered with the gun because he doesn't have the intent. He hasn't removed it. He hasn't destroyed it. He hasn't concealed it. He hasn't altered it. So in this case, he has done at least one or two of those things. He's removed it. He's attempting to sell it, all with the intent to obstruct the investigation. So this is more than merely possessing the gun. He has done far more than that. This is similar to the Seventh Circuit has a case called Wise, where the gun itself is where the enhancement comes into play because he left it somewhere where a child could pick it up. This is, and again, other circuits have looked at tampering and said, yes, it technically applies. I think it's the Tenth Circuit and a couple of other circuits. So we think it does technically apply, and again, we think that Judge McNulty, to the extent there was an error, and we don't think there was one, rendered it harmless by saying, I'm going to vary by those four levels, get back to the range that would apply otherwise. Court, have any other questions? I would ask that you affirm.
I have none. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Very much, Mr. Romano. And we'll hear from Ms. Oliveira in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. To answer the court's question, the actus reus of the tampering offense is possessing the firearm. This court...
What about the conversations where he's trying to unload the firearm, you get rid of it?
So those are the jail call recordings, and they do communicate that he possessed the firearm. The intent is key, but the law of this circuit looks at a distinction in time or conduct. And the only conduct that we have here is possession of the firearm, whether you call it taking the firearm, hiding the firearm, whatever you want to say it is. At the end of the day, all he did was possess the firearm. This court has always interpreted another felony offense to mean that there is a prohibition on double counting. And this is exactly what we have here. This isn't a burglary. This isn't an assault where there's a breaking and entering. There's a threat. There's something else that's done with the firearm. Here,
is it a crime under that New Jersey statute to attempt to tamper with evidence?
It's not. As we presented to the court, we recognize that this was an unpreserved argument, but the government has not been able to present the court with one case that shows that the New Jersey evidence tampering statute applies to the fact of this case.
To the attempt,
that's correct. The New Jersey Supreme Court's case in Mendez interprets the evidence tampering statute only to apply to attempts to tamper with evidence where there's some sort of permanent element, some permanent concealment, permanent alteration, something like that. They say that this statute doesn't apply to unsuccessful attempts to hide or discard contraband, and they provide a policy justification for that, which is that contraband is almost always hidden or discarded, and when it's recovered, it's of undiminished value to law enforcement. So it makes no sense to be charging people for unsuccessful attempts to hide or tamper with evidence. One more point on the harmlessness issue. When Judge McNulty declares this a hollow victory for the government, he does not do this when he's pronouncing sentence. It's during the sentencing arguments. And right after he says that it's a hollow victory, he makes clear that he can still be convinced.
But I did read that. I made a pretty good review during the initial argument. apologize for that, but I was again trying to peruse the transcript of the sentencing proceeding, which I read the entire proceeding. It is just crystal clear to me that what he was doing was yielding to the prosecution's proper insanity, applying this four-level enhancement, but then fixing it right away. I mean, there's no way to read that transcript in his remarks and not come away thinking that what he did was think that, okay, it technically applies, but I'm going to take care of this.
I don't dispute the fact that Judge McNulty tried to, what he says, undo much of the effect of this enhancement. Our position is that granting a variance based on disagreement with the enhancement is not the same as not taking it into account at all. This enhancement was front and center during the sentencing hearing. Judge McNulty heard argument on it. He discussed what parts of the argument he found persuasive, which parts he didn't. And he did give us many reasons for granting a variance, but what he didn't give us was reasons why he wasn't going to take this into account.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Romano. We appreciate the excellent arguments you have both provided us. The panel will take the case under